Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, and we here at the Shattered Lives radio show are very excited to welcome you to this unique show, taking you beyond the details of the crime and the perpetrator and getting to the heart of what crime victim families experience and what they need in the aftermath of the crime. Prior to each show, please go to www.donnagore.com. That's donnagore.com or imaginepublicity.com to read the background of the case or the organization featured the week before our show is aired. And please don't forget that in case you cannot listen to our show live from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern, you can always listen using our archival feature within the next 24 hours. Just look for the big red heart with the cracks. So good evening again, everyone, and welcome to Shattered Lives. This is Donna, a.k.a. Lady Justice, welcoming you again. And I have to say it's a beautiful day here in Connecticut, and I hope it is where you are. Before I bring on our very esteemed guest, it's someone that I've been very much looking forward to having on for several weeks, but she's a popular and a busy lady, so we're glad to have her today. I wanted to make a couple of announcements, and they have to do with our very good friend and my mentor, of course, Susan Murphy Milano, the intimate partner homicide expert who unfortunately a few weeks ago was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer in a few organs. But I have to tell you that since that time, it has been a situation where we are looking at it in terms of the glass being half full. She is being treated by a wonderful facility, a wonderful doctor with many different methods, and she's got a wonderful group of supportive people. However, we are looking for help in a number of areas, if you can possibly. She has a brand new blog that Delilah set up, and it's www.conqueringcancer.me. And her autobiography, Holding My Hand Through Hell, will be out soon. And you can also go to her website, murphymilano.com, and pre-order that. And, of course, her revolutionary documentTheAbuse.com materials. If you know of someone or you yourself are endangered in a domestic violence situation, please, please do go, because it is very helpful. And I have to say, Delilah Jones, my co-pilot here, my friend, my PR manager, is the heart and soul of Imagine Publicity. She works wonders with all of her clients. She can do simple to complex things. Her specialty is social marketing. And I have to say that I'm very proud that she has just jumped in with both feet and to assist in every way possible. I like to call her Annie Sullivan because she's done miracles for Susan. And I can't tell you how proud I am of the way she's responded to the call, and everyone should have a friend like Delilah. So, Delilah, thank you so much for what you're doing with Susan. Thank you so much for
what you do for
me. Well, thank
you, Donna. I'm not the miracle worker. I can support and hold somebody up, but that's about it. But
you do a lot more than that. But thank you for saying so. And everyone, you just need to, you know, if you have an unsung hero in your life, you have to once in a while tell people about them, and you're the unsung hero here. So anyway, just so that people know, you know, I applaud you and thank you so much for what you're doing. So I don't know what I want to say about me. Do you have anything you'd like to tell? You know pretty much in and out, and then we'll get to Abby in just a minute.
Yeah, I think one thing I'd like to let the listeners know what's coming up next week, which you have single-handedly almost put this all together. You and Denny Griffin, who is a true crime author, Las Vegas mob historian, and he's also the host of Crime Wire here, right here on Blog Talk Radio. The two of you are getting together and taking a tour of the Henry C. Lee Institute, which I think is just totally exciting. And then you're also going to broadcast live a two-hour special live from the Henry Lee Institute, so, and interview Dr. Lee. So I'm really excited about that. I'm going to be running the switchboard. I won't be a guest. I won't be a co-host, but I will be listening in. And we've already had Tim Palmbach on, and he was so engaging. So I'm looking forward to that on Thursday, this coming Thursday, June 28th.
We're really going to do all that? I guess I better get busy.
I guess
yeah.
So.
I'm trying to be funny. I really am looking forward to it. It's such an honor, and I think it will be very rewarding and very informational for all of our listeners. So that's one new thing we have on tap. We've got a lot of new things on tap, and that's why we're here to do what we do. So without further ado, let me tell you a little bit about my dear friend, Addie Carone. Addie Carone is also a Connecticut resident. In fact, we just live a few miles away from each other, and we know each other by virtue of homicide, unfortunately. As you might have read in the promotional post that Delilah put up, Addie's twin son, Peter, was killed in 1987 by virtue of an offhanded comment while watching a sporting event at a local watering hole, and things turned very bad from there. And we learned just how evil this person was that committed the homicide. And I'm not even going to say his name because I don't think he deserves it. We'll just say AZ. For the sake of discussion. And this was an ordeal that spanned many, many years, and that's what makes this so unique. And I'm so gratified that Addie has come on and agreed to do this, because she could have just said, let's forget about it. But she's being very nice to all of us and trying to help educate. So I will bring her on. Addie, please welcome to Shattered Life. Thank you so much for being on with us this evening.
Well, thank you, Donna. It's my pleasure to be with you, and also with you, Delilah. It's a first for me, so it's going to be very interesting. Thank you.
I'm totally honored.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Well, I am too, because you've always been a heroine to me, a very dignified lady. And in fact, I should tell people that after my dad's homicide in 1981, when I got started with Survivors of Homicide, I was doing other volunteerism, so to speak, with crime victims in doing court escorting at the Hartford Superior Court. And one of the cases that I had the pleasure of sitting in on and trying to advise was with Addie and her family going through the entire process. And let me tell you, it was, you know, it was really an eye-opening experience. It was an honor to be with her, and she handled everything with such grace. And it's something I'll never forget. It will always stay with me. And so
you're very kind. Thank you,
well,
Donna.
You're welcome. From there began our 30-year relationship. We had a little bit of time in there where we've lost touch, but I've always thought of her often. So now here we are on our national radio show. Addie, there's many things that we could talk about, and like I say, I want this focus to be not on the perpetrator, but on other aspects, because I think it'd be more helpful to our audience. And knowing that it's unusual that it was a convicted murderer who was let out on bond and that he was a fugitive for many years, and your case took on international proportions in that he hid out in a foreign country, and that the perpetrator's family actually aided and abetted him in being able to stay under the radar, despite publicity and perhaps some pending lawsuits. With all of that going on, Addie, as you look back over the years, you know, at your devastating loss of Peter, How do you think that you have come full circle in some way? And can you tell us right now in 2012, is there a particular emotion or feeling that you grapple with today, as opposed to when it was so new and fresh?
Well, you know, the murder occurred, as you well know, in 1987, Donna, and that's 25 years ago.
Right.
But I also have to add this to it. For me, the emotions ran very, very high because at that time in March, my husband of 35 years had been diagnosed with lung cancer in January,
mm-hmm.
and was given just 6 months to live. So when Peter was killed, Vin was quite ill at the time. So not only did I have to cope with the problems that occur when you're losing a wonderful husband and father, as he was,
mm-hmm.
And coping with all the medical things that have to be done, I also had to remember that we had something serious going on, which was the murder of our son. And part of that was a little bit sad because, particularly toward the end, I don't think that Vince was quite aware of what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
Except there was one very, very small time, which was at our wake in the viewing of Peter. And I do remember Vince saying to him, "I'll see you soon." And so I think he was aware that his time was short, and hopefully I my wish is that they are together. Now, I don't want to add to this, but at the same time, my mother, who was 87 years old, was also diagnosed. She had colon cancer. The operation appeared successful, but obviously she wasn't. So in October, my mother died. And then
wow.
to add to this is I was still working. I was a social worker designee in a senior community, multi-level community. And was diagnosed with benign cancer, but I had to have a complete hysterectomy. So from March until October of that year, there was a lot going on. So
that's almost more than a person can handle. I'm wondering, Addie, how did you hold up during all of this? What was your support group like?
Well, my support group was many, and it's interesting, Delilah and Donna, preparing for this afternoon. I was out on my porch, and as Donna said, it's a gorgeous day today here in Connecticut. And I came across some writings and things that I had done. And one was when Donna and I were members of the Survivors of Homicide. And I started with them, I think, in probably 89. I just couldn't get myself to get there much sooner than that. And a writing course was going to get started, and that was occurring in, I had the note on it from the survivors, and that was going to be taking place in 1999. And I did write a story, and unfortunately, that project fell apart. Donna may know more about that. I don't know. So I had the support. You asked about the support.
Mm-hmm.
I had the support of the survivors group, number one. But also, I'm lucky to have had a very, very large family that was based in another town just about an hour away from here. So I came from a family of three other sisters, a brother, nieces and nephews, and also aunts. I grew up in a very large family of very, very strong people, including the grandmother for whom I'm named, and with a very, very large family. There are a lot of things that go on. When I say a large family, I grew up with very strong aunts and uncles, and there were 12 of them. And we were a very, very close family. So not only did I have the aunts and uncles and a very strong, independent grandmother, but I also had cousins. And we are a strong family. And I learned a lot from that family. And another part of that was I grew up in World War II. And I had a brother, Joe, who was killed on the island of Iwo Jima in the Marines. And to this day, we have a park that's named for my brother that's in the town that I grew up in. So if we put all of those together, that's where I got my support from. And the other place that I got my support from was the facility in which I was working. I was the social worker designee. I was designated to be the social worker at that particular time because I started there in 1985. And they gave me a tremendous amount of support. But every day that I was working there and working with our residents, I was very aware of the fact that I could not break down at any time, because if the social worker breaks down, if the social worker designee breaks down and gets emotional, gets upset, or gets angry, that doesn't put my job in a very, very good light. And I don't know, it never happened. So I had to maintain a very, very strong appearance.
But it seemed like such a delicate balancing act. You're dealing with your husband's grave illness, with the murder. How did you figure out a system for like dividing your time? And I'm just amazed.
I had no system. I didn't come home and say, okay, at 6 o'clock I'm going to cry or this is going to happen.
You were dealing with so many things simultaneously. You must have a very strong constitution. People kid me like from Delilah's neck of the woods, and they call us Yankees. Mm-hmm. We strong Yankees.
We are. Yeah.
You're part of that heritage,
You are.
Right.
You really are. I've met so many women from Connecticut, and you New England women are really, you're a breed.
that old Yankee spirit, I guess it's true, Delilah. But, as I talked about my family growing up with 12 aunts and uncles in World War II, I witnessed and was part of deaths occurring in our family. And something that I do remember when I was working, we had a fairly young lady who was working in our business office, and she was the only child. The parents were divorced, and she was going through the serious illness of her mother, who eventually did die. And I remember she sought me out one day and said, "Addie, I don't know what to do." And what she was talking about are just the simple things. Where do you go after your mother dies? Do you go to the funeral home? Do you call a doctor? What do you do? She had no idea. Because she hadn't been through it. She didn't know anything about a wake. You didn't know that you had to have calling hours if that's what she wanted. I had been through that so many times.
So you were able to kind of tell her from your own experience.
Exactly.
That I thought that was very helpful.
Exactly. Plus, working where I did, where I worked with a fairly aging population, especially when I was in the nursing home, part of my responsibility was to hear stories. And some of the stories I heard were very, very unpleasant. And talk about strong ladies. I worked with some very, very, very strong ladies. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So, you put that all together. It's never, it's never one thing. It's a combination of so many things all the time. It really is.
Well, so. I'm just, so impressed that you were able to juggle all those things. But, they always say that God never gives you more than you can handle. And
that's right.
I'm really thinking now and knowing, how our friend is so ill that I'm going back to those kinds of thoughts more and more because so much of it is your constitution or how spiritual you are or your belief in God as well as, medicine helping you. So the combination of all those forces, But
absolutely.
Kind of skipping to another aspect, I was wondering You know, in all of these years, like 22 years.
Well, it's really 25 right now, up to now.
Mm-hmm. But how are you treated by, quote, the system, the layers of system, whether it be the court, the police, how you know, society in general after the homicide happened, whether or not you want to say I know of a couple of experiences you had with the opposing families, but I'm just wondering, you know, in general, do you feel as if you you had fairly good treatment overall by the system in going through the process of the criminal
justice? I had fantastic treatment. I had no problem at all. None at all. I had no contact at all with any members of the family of AZ.
Mm-hmm.
So I have no idea. You know, it was only what I was told.
Okay.
And I did. I had wonderful because after I realized when I took care of my own family business and went through, you know, that grieving process, I had to figure out what can I do here. Nothing was happening, and Adam had disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know his first name now, don't we?
That's okay.
Yeah.
You're allowed. I was just doing it out of respect for you.
Yeah, right. Well, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Well, perhaps we ought to let people know his name. I'm going to leave that to you. But anyway, once I was determined, it just happened naturally, Donna, as to what I had to do. So I would pick up a phone and I would contact FBI agents in the Hartford area, always very welcoming to me. When I suggested that if I could, rather than discuss anything on the phone, can I come and see them? They immediately said, fine, name a date, and I walked. And FBI group changed a lot. There was always somebody else I talked to from year to year. I did that with the police department. I called up, told them who I was, and it was very, very interesting. Practically everyone I talked to, the minute I mentioned my name and why I wanted to talk to them, they knew the story. They knew the case. So that was very, very easy. But I had no problem at all. I am totally grateful to the entire police department, FBI agents, the U.S. Marshals, and everyone. They were wonderful. I got wonderful treatment from. No one ever said to me, "I'm sorry, I'm terribly busy." The words I did hear, which I wasn't crazy about hearing, is it's an open case. We are trying it. It had always been an open case. And I once took my sister and brother-in-law down to New Haven, where I grew up, and met an agent there and was in his office, and we spent a lot of time. And again, he showed me, you know, all the things that they were working on without divulging too much. But I had to answer that question. I had wonderful treatment. Wonderful treatment. Absolutely.
Well, that is very rare, because we hear much of the opposite story in all of the crime victims that we work with. So that's very refreshing. But I just have to think that, you know, from it going from a town, a municipality, you know, fairly small, West Hartford, Connecticut, and take on international proportions and being on America's Most Wanted, three times. What was that like in making that transition from it being very local, you know, down the road from your house to where it occurred to, you know, this international aspect?
Well, I was very, very pleased with that, except for the very last time. Because in most cases, I remember going, I think for the first one, I went to the West Hartford Police Department. Another time, I think, I forgot the first two. I'm not terribly clear about that. But the third one I do remember, and that was the last one, which occurred once the West Hartford Detective Division opened the case, and that was in, it was 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was told that they were coming to the house, and the thing that I remember most, I was very, very glad to have them there, but they didn't tell me what they would bring with them, which were, and I was working at the time, so I came home, they came in early evening, and this isn't a terrible criticism because they had a job to do, but they turned my house upside down. They really did. They came in, moved furniture in the living room, had these massive lights shining upon me, went through the kitchen, moved a refrigerator from one location to another.
Really?
In other words, they were really making a set here, moving, and I found that uncomfortable.
It's disconcerting,
disconcerting.
Your whole environment.
They
but
did.
Now this was one of the shows for
this was the very last show for America's Most Wanted, and quite honestly, I did express my criticism to the one of the detectives who then in tow one of the people who had arranged this, and see he was in Washington D.C. I wouldn't do that again.
They kind of went overboard with that.
I think so.
Turned your house upside down.
Absolutely.
Why couldn't they just interview you on your couch, Addie?
You're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, I'll have to tell you this, Donna. The head fellow was a very nice young fellow. They were all very, very pleasant. But, boy, they went around their business like they were setting up a show for a Hollywood movie or something. And when I say moved everything around, they really did. They went out into a porch, put things that they felt they didn't need, moved chairs here and there. They didn't move the sofa, but they certainly moved chairs. But anyway, he directed me, and he wanted me to go into the kitchen. And with that, he wanted me to open the kitchen cupboard and pretend I was taking out a cup or a glass or something. And by this time, I think I was a little bit tired, number one. And I said, no, I don't want to do this.
Good for you.
But he said, he was a little taken back by it. His first name was Peter. He asked me why, and I said, no, I'm just uncomfortable for doing this. But
yeah.
And so he did.
You got through it anyway, right?
Yeah, right. But I have to tell you this. Through the years, we all watch television. And when they do a show, I am so aware of how they do a show now. You take a look at it, whether it's 2020, any of the big-name shows. What do they do? They'll have someone walking in a park with their dog. They have someone sitting somewhere else. So that's all part.
It's all staged.
It's all staged. It's all part of the picture, and that's what they.
That was quite an education, then, I'm sure.
Yes, it was, and I realized. But no criticism, and I don't know how much this has to do with what we're talking about. But I think what they should have done, and they were remiss in doing that, is just tell me the day before, talk with me. And maybe this is a good thing for you to know too, Delilah. I'm not sure, you know, how much work you involve with staging anything like this. But tell the people that you're going to do this, what it's going to be like. Well, we may have to move a chair. We may do this. We may go in the other room. I was taken completely unawares. That was the bottom line. So that was, you asked about how I was treated. I was treated well, but it was a negative experience for me.
Yeah, that just seems so disconcerting and very unfair. So, but you know, if that was the worst, I guess you know it's something we could tolerate for the sake of that show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I would love for you to be able to. We were discussing earlier today, maybe you know, we always key into you know the emotional aspects of how we're dealing with violent crime and the psychological effects, perhaps. But there are physical manifestations, and I remember you sharing something with me, and I thought that was very interesting, and maybe you'd like to talk about that because it's kind of not
mm-hmm.
really discussed very much in terms of, mm-hmm. what happened with you.
Right. Well, you hear the expression, my heart is broken or my heart aches. yes. There's even a song. I used to dance to that song by Ted Weems. It was called Heartaches. And I have a CD. I went on Amazon a few years ago and got Heartaches. And you know what? Yes. I'm dating myself now. People talk about. I don't remember. Well, I remember listening to him. He's long, long gone. But it's a wonderful show. It's a song. And
yes.
Someday I'll let you listen to it, Donna.
I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. But anyway, it's true.
Mm-hmm.
My heart, physically, I ached. It was so real. It was so real. You're at the depths of your sadness and disbelief. And, of course, you have to remember, I had three people to worry about.
Right.
And think about. Although because my mother was 87, you know, it's a natural thing. My husband was young, and that, I had hoped that had never happened, but it did because he was so positive and was going to live to be 100. But the physical ache that I did have, and it so happened that a good friend of mine wrote a little column for our paper, the local paper in town, and she and her family, or her husband, had lost a son quite tragically in a motorcycle accident. And I remember she wrote in her article that it was a few years before Peter, that she no longer had that ache. She still was hurt by what had happened and the trauma that follows that. But little by little, each year it was going away. And it's true. It's true.
And that statement struck you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely it. Did. Right.
Did that come on right away, Addie?
Oh, gosh.
You mean
yes.
After the
oh,
homicide?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yes, the loss is so, and really, you really, it's a pain. It's, how do you explain pain to people? All I can tell you, it wasn't like the pain if you have a toothache, but mm-hmm. there is something within you, and you know what? It's near your heart. It's in your upper part of the body. It's around your chest. It's not mm-hmm. in your leg or your thigh or
yeah.
your neck or anything. It's right there. It's very true. Your heart mm-hmm. aches, no question about it. It did.
Well, I've always heard it said, and I'm sure, Delilah, you've heard this too, that the worst thing to deal with on the spectrum of loss is the loss of a child. I mean, I lost a parent. And so a parent, and I was a young adult at that time. I wasn't even a child. I was 26 years old when my father was killed. But, you know, that is very different. And, for example, Sharon and Gary Merton at the time, survivors of homicide, lost their
yes.
very young teenage daughter. And that's what I say, that, you know, I know what loss is, but I cannot relate to your loss specifically, because that supposedly is the most traumatic. If you were to lose, God forbid, Delilah, your daughter or anyone, that's the worst in the world. And that's what people say, and I totally believe that. So you're affirming that with this physical ache, Addie. You know, and
well,
I'm sure doctors would confirm that.
Well, I think it's true. But
yeah.
there's always, you know, we all have our own memories, and I think of this
of
with
course.
Peter quite often. My brother, who was the Marine on Iwo, was killed on March 15th. And my family, my sisters and brother-in-law, and my son Jim and his wife had come up, and Peter was here. And I remember we were downstairs in the basement. I think he had some laundry to do. And, you know, he just broke down. He just broke down. And it was just a week before he himself was killed, you know. He
that
was
right. Wow.
Yeah, he was so sad about his father because, you know,
right.
his father was such a strong man
vibrant
and
man.
Vibrant and so full of life. And so was Peter. And that's a memory that stays with me. And we, as you said earlier in the introduction, Peter is also a twin. And,
right. Can you talk a little bit about that and how, you know, the other members of your family and how this might have created
well,
the domino
yes,
effect?
It did. I'm very happy to say that I'm a mother of three boys. My son, Jim, mm-hmm. I'm always happy to talk about the twins because they were the healthiest, biggest babies born at the hospital in a long, long time. So they weren't preemies at all. They went right full term. So And Jim, their brother, their oldest brother, was only two when they were born. And this was a big thing in our family, so they were referred to as all the time for the longest time, you know, as the twins. My father doted on those boys, and he used to call them his little rascals. That was hard because there's half of our family. I mean, they were always together. They were identical. And Michael, to this day, and the birthday is June 9th, so that was only a couple of weeks ago. And
right.
The first year, Michael was here with his wife and his daughter. She was only about three or four at the time. I had a birthday cake, and he just broke down and cried. And he told me he doesn't want to celebrate his birthday. We observe it. We have a cake, but it's something he does not look forward to at all. It's Michael doesn't talk about it a lot. I think he's kept a lot of things in, and to this day, there's not much that he likes to talk about with his brother.
Mm-hmm.
So it's with him. I'm sure he still aches. It's a bond. I mean, that twinship
right.
is such a bond when you think about it. So,
yeah.
So that's been hard.
And how is Jim doing?
Jim is fine. You know, he's the older brother,
right.
even though it's only by 2 years. So
mm-hmm.
Certainly he's affected by it, because he was newly married when this happened. And, it affects everyone. I mean, family still talks about this. I was talking to my sister the other day who attended the wake and funeral of a young mother of seven children. Who was killed in an automobile accident, and her husband was driving the car. And Evelyn was aware that there were so many people. She said the place was just packed, young people. And what she said then is, you know, it reminded me of Peter's wake, where
right.
they had to have a policeman in the middle of the street for traffic, because it was filled with so many young people. And when someone young dies, as you said, the loss of a child, we hear that all the time. No parent
sure.
wants to lose a child. But when you see the casket of your son, as Vince and I stood by at the funeral home, ready to get to the church, and you mm-hmm. see his friends that were at your house, you know, doing all sorts of things that young men and teenagers and all do, playing
mm-hmm.
football and games. He was a member of a soccer team. And when you see those young men carry your son's body out, I tell you, that's when it truly hits. It really
of
does.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure it does. And I'm just, you know, the longevity of this whole ordeal, I just marvel at, you know, your ability, even after, you know, the other deaths that occurred in your family. And I'm just wondering, you know, you have a particular life now. It's very different, but you have a routine and you have things that you enjoy doing, or maybe you could term it a semblance of a new normalcy, whatever that may be. But for other people who have had losses who are listening, for someone who has gone through such a long ordeal, Addie, what would you want to say to perhaps other homicide survivors who maybe do not have the constitution that you do, or are kind of short on hope? What advice would you give them, perhaps?
Well, something that I found very, very helpful, and I was looking through a couple of things today. I don't have all the written material that I have garnered through these past 25 years
mm-hmm.
with me.
You mean like a timeline?
Not necessarily a timeline, but I did write in a journal. I had two journals. One friend, unfortunately, she was a young lady who gave it to me, and it was a wonderful notebook, and I have the title right here, and it's called, name of the book she gave to me was Time Remembered. It's called Journal for Survivors by Earl A. Grolman. I imagine if you get it on, go to Amazon, look it up, you probably can get it. So in it were just all blank pages. But on the pages before you wrote, there were quotes from various people, some unknown and some well-known. So if I can take a moment and read
please give you
an example.
Yes,
this is one here. It says, as the scars begin to heal, I feel like a tree covering itself with new growth. The world sings a broken song. My loved one is dead, but I'm alive. It's time to start living again. And this is reflections following the anniversary of a death.
Wow.
Then they kind of cue you as to what you have done and how you're feeling. So the next paragraph is this. However long and dark the night, the dawn is sure to break. Look into the mirror again. How do you think you have changed since the death of your loved ones? What new goals are you setting for yourself 1 month from now and 1 year from now? And how can they best be achieved? Congratulate yourself on your survival and progress. And then I wrote in this, and I didn't always follow what they suggested. These were just how I felt.
I
started this journal in the 90s, and I would wake up. I didn't go to bed and say, okay, I'm going to write in my journal. It just happened. I would just feel like writing that night before I went to sleep, or sometimes I'd wake up in the middle of the night.
Well, it sounds very therapeutic, and like you say, maybe what they wrote cued you to think about some other aspect, and it helped you. And I have to say, I write prolifically all the time, and it's very good therapy for me, and I love it.
Okay.
And if I didn't have that, then I don't know what I would do, because I'm I don't play musical instruments anymore. I was terrible at the organ and the clarinet.
But I did what I said on that. I called it the 10th anniversary and said there are things to plan and observe to remember you both in a special way. Me both meaning my husband and Peter. And this is the year you and Mike, his twin brother, will be 40. Yes, strange, but I will always connect you with Michael. The healing is starting, and I know I have to let go, but I can't yet. I'm back with the survivors group, and the first words out of my mouth last night as the new year came in were words for AZ. And I know it won't stop until he is caught, and how I pray for that. And then I go on to say our family is growing and is wonderful. Kathleen, who's the young lady that was engaged to be married to Peter that August, she visited with me early in the week. And then I hope that this will be a good year for us. And I end by saying, be with us. So writing.
That is so touching, Addie. That's so beautiful.
Well, writing is so therapeutic.
It is.
It's interesting because after a while, I did stop. I had... I think I said it in one. I don't have all my, all my books with me. I had two books, and I realized that I had stopped. So
It maybe that was a need that you had to fulfill at that particular point, but maybe you felt like you wanted to move on to do other things.
Oh yeah.
How is Kathleen? Do you keep in touch with her?
I saw her. Her birthday is very close to Peter's. It's June 8th. So we still see each other. Yeah, she doesn't live far from me. She bought a nice house. She doesn't live far from me. She's
Can you share with our audience a little bit of background that Peter was engaged, correct?
They were engaged.
Got to be engaged at that point.
They were engaged. They were to be married in August. Matter of fact, I have a large box that's up in the attic, and in that box are filled with all the mementos and letters and the service and the program that I've kept there for a long, long time. And on the refrigerator for a long time was their announcement. They came to show what they were going to say in their announcement, that, you know, the wedding announcements. And I had that on the refrigerator for a long, long time. Yeah, they were going to be married in August. Yes.
And that was in, what, March, right?
Peter was killed in March, and they were planning to be married in August. They were engaged at Christmas time. We have a picture in the living room here with them.
And it's so special that you still see her in our clothes. I think that's
precious. Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
Was it a plan of yours to try through all the intervening years to try to keep it in the public eye as much as possible?
Oh, absolutely.
And if and how was that possible, and who might have been responsible? Was it again?
Well, I think you have to take the bull by the horns, and you have to do it yourself. Let me be honest with you. People were my family and my sons. Were supportive, but, you know, we have to remember my sons were newly married. Jim was first. They're starting their families. Jim was also in New York City. They're working on their own careers. So they couldn't give me the actual, you know, daily support. Either could my family down in New Haven, sisters. I mean, everybody had a life.
Right.
You have to remember that.
So I
had to do it myself. So I think certainly we all know that. I mean, I have a teacher's background, so this isn't a compliment to me, but I think I know how to speak to people and ask people things. I think I ought to. Plus, you know, my work is a social worker. This isn't being boastful. It's just a very objective point that I'm making.
Sure.
So I would pick up the phone, and I had no problems talking with the reporters at the Hartford Courant who did, especially when I was getting the bill passed. And those reporters, those reporters are still around. And I have all those clippings, and they gave me wonderful publicity on in the newspapers. You know, I called up the head of the police department, Chief Stralacci, who's just retired this past year.
In West Hartford,
went to see him, you know, sat in his office, and he talked with me. So I did that with everybody that I possibly could. Absolutely.
To keep it going, to keep it in the public eye.
Yes. Well, with the bill especially. To keep it in the public eye.
Why don't you tell us about that aspect of what I mean, I know, but what happened with respect to the conviction, and what was it that you did legislatively? We've got about 12 minutes.
Okay. Well, your listeners don't know that Adam was sentenced to 60 years in prison. And he was out. He had the judge issued only there were four conditions on which he be able to come back and face jail. Essentially what it was, they were just four of nothing, really. One was to stay at home with his parents.
Right.
Two, not to have, be sure he had no guns,
mother
and father. The third, I think, was that the family was. And, of course, it was as if the judge was saying, now, Adam, you go home with your parents. And they were living in a condo in town here. And you be a very good boy. You know, you stay at home. You have to come in. You have to obey all these rules and regulations. And then don't forget, when you come back in October, you're going to go to jail for 60 years. And can you see Adam saying, oh, of course, Judge, I'll be a good boy, and I'll be back here. And
no,
I was just,
it's
and
so
I was,
ludicrous. It's
and
so
I was,
ludicrous.
I was just reviewing, you know, I have so much with me. It really came in very handy when I gave a statement at Fred Zaks, because that's when I really spoke. And I spoke for 45 minutes, which was unusual. And a judge Arterton, there was a female judge, I thought was more than welcoming to me to allow me to take so much time. But it were things that I never had a chance to say to the family, and that just didn't spill out because I had written it time and time again. So
so the fact that he, getting back for a minute to the legislation,
yes.
he was let out
yes,
on
he
a
was
fine,
let, yeah.
and that was
it
the,
was
the,
actually,
the Connecticut statute
it was a,
at the time.
It was a $250,000 bond, and
right.
here again, the family will try anything that they can to do what they can to not listen to what the courts are saying all the time. I put it as simply as that. Because
right. Right.
the aunt found something. She felt that there was a delay in her learning about this. And as a result of that, that bond of $250,000 was reduced to a mere $125,000. Now, we have to remember here, this is a family of some financial means.
Right.
They're in a business, and there is a lot of money there. So with that, and I do have an attorney, and
yeah.
he will be nameless right now,
right.
I sat with him, and I tried to figure out, and I think working with survivors at that time, what
yeah.
can I do? And also a neighbor. I have a neighbor who was connected with the legalities in Hartford
mm-hmm.
and with the legislature. And I got a lot of advice from them and found that I, as a private citizen, can go ahead and try and get a bill passed. And that's what I did. And that
right.
was very, very difficult for me because I did not have a computer. The bill was passed in 1999. And I had I had a Wednesday off. I worked 4 days a week. Every Wednesday by myself, I came and did whatever work I had to do. And one of the hardest things was when it was time for me to make that announcement, I had to do my own speech. I was at the legislative building at 8 o'clock in the morning and did not speak until 6 o'clock in the evening.
I know how that goes. I've done that twice.
You know how that goes, right.
Yes, I do.
But before that, I also had to write letters. It was important for me to write letters to our senators and representatives in the state of Connecticut, sent
right.
them a letter. One of the key points, not it wasn't a key point, but some wonderful advice was, is when you write these letters, is don't put them on standard white paper, but put them on something colorful. So I remember I had a kind of a glowy yellow paper that I put these on, and
you
it's
did.
Obvious. Yes, I did. Right.
Wow.
They were all
okay.
written on this bright yellow. Went over to. Office Depot or Staples,
yeah.
I guess, and got that. And I single-handedly, all by myself, I remember how...
The whole General Assembly, you wrote individual letters?
Yes. No,
wow,
no, it was no. Oh, heavens, no. It wasn't individual letters. It was the same letter, but
right.
I addressed it to whatever. So I had... I don't remember
yeah.
putting their names down. I don't think
yeah.
I didn't. But
well, can you tell us what the purpose
yes,
of the legislation
yes,
was?
Yes, yes. And you know what? I just wanted to be sure, and
yeah.
I wrote it down. And I know
okay.
that you said you could not get this on your computer, but it simply means that if you are out on appeal. You know, I'm not going to read the legalese of this.
Right, no, just tell us in one sentence what it was about.
Simply stated,
yep.
if you're out on appeal, now you appeal from jail. That was our problem, you see. Adam was at home, and indeed, if he was home for at least an hour, because we know now in this final investigation and the finality of this finding Adam, and
yeah.
Knowing that what his father did. By the way, you said family. I think it was not the family that harbored him with money. It was primarily the father and two of his two people that he knew.
Right.
The family may, I don't know if they really knew anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I just lost my train of thought on that one now.
That's okay. So it was built, when you're out on appeal, you have to stay
yeah, right. Right. Yeah, it's called
And it's my understanding, Addie, that I think they also use this with one of the appeals from Michael Skakel.
Yes.
Am
exactly.
I right on that?
Yes. Oh yeah. Yeah. He's appealed 7 times, and I won't give it to you now, but I don't know if your listeners want to go on and see that, but I have it here.
Sure.
It's Public Act 98-51 called House Bill 5637, and it's an act concerning post-bail conviction, signed into law June 29th, 1998 by the then Governor John Rowland.
Okay, can you give me that date again? It was June what?
June 29th, 1998.
Okay, good. Yeah, I can find that, and it'll be on our
mm-hmm.
archives here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, our time is fast going here. Delilah, would you like to chime in here and maybe ask a couple of things at the end?
I'm just fascinated. You know, I've read some about the case, Addie, a lot.
Yeah.
Donna's written several different posts about it, so I am somewhat familiar with it. You know, I guess, and I know we just have a few seconds or a few minutes left, I can't imagine after coming this far for this long and then to finally have, there's never closure, but coming together, so to speak, where he's finally caught, the father's arrested, and things are coming together to sort of end this. What are your feelings and how that has played such a big part in your life over the last 25 years? How do you see things now, today? Good
well,
question.
You know, I think the bottom line is one does what they have to do. That's what it is.
True.
Do what you have to do. And I did.
Right.
I was lucky that, you know, physically and mentally, emotionally, I was able to do it. And I'm looking through the notes in the story I wrote, and, you know, I've got so much that I say in here. And I am very, very pleased with the justice system. I have nothing to say but just very, very good things. They were open to me. They were kind. They were helpful. They were just wonderful. As a matter of fact, when Adam was caught, I immediately sat down and wrote a letter to the editor of our local paper praising the West Hartford Police Department because it was that homicide division of the Detective Bureau who did all the work. And
they're so tenacious, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. They were relentless in their search to find him. And as I said to Donna, I think Donna knows this, I wasn't happy about doing this. I mean, it's 25 years. I'm now a very, very senior lady. And you have to go on. I mean, we never forget.
You can put closure on this, and this is a legacy for other people to learn from you. So I express my gratitude to you to the utmost, Addie. You're so gracious. You're such a lady, and I do appreciate it. And I just want to say a couple of parting comments. I think.
Okay, can I just say something about that?
Sure, go ahead.
Because
yes.
I don't know whether you're aware, but it's really not over anymore. Adam had been transferred from a jail, I think, somewhere in another part, and I know where he is now. He's in a small town. And I, coming from where I live to that town, I've gone by that facility. It used to be strictly what we would call in the old days a reform school. But that's where he is now. Do you know that he has hired an attorney to open this case?
Yes, I remember
hearing about that.
Isn't
that
that's just as insult to injury, and you know, opening it up again. But I'm sure you're gonna handle it in your way.
Well,
and we'll be there watching, and I hope you'll keep up with me, and so that we'll keep in contact, and I can let people know that you're still doing very good things. And again, I thank you so much. We're going to have to say goodnight for now. I'll
right.
talk to you later, okay, off air. I'd be glad to. So, Delilah, thank you so much for everything, all of your listeners. Please, everyone, be sure to tune in next Saturday evening. It's Ray Bouchard with the Human Trafficking and the Berlin Turnpike author. And so good night. Be safe. And remember, if you want to help crime victims, don't just try. Make it happen. Good night, everyone, and thank you.
Thank you, Donna.
You're welcome, Eddie.